about $11 million per year. The Port Authority's profit from the joint program in hard cash was thus about $16,500,000 per year. By 1970, Triborough was collecting $11 million annually in tolls on the Verrazano Bridge, $7,500,000 on the Throgs Neck Bridge, a hard cash profit of $18,500,000 per year. Given the added assets of power that Moses put into the partnership, both parties came out just about even. The two giant authorities were dividing the potential profits from the city's traffic as if congestion were a large and succulent pie. And Moses, who got the slice he wanted, was ecstatic. Talking to a reporter about the Narrows Bridge just before the joint program was released, he was again the young man, burning with ideas, unable to contain his enthusiasm. Unable to sit still, striding around his office with smiles breaking through the studiedly aloof mask he habitually wore now, forgetting to fold his arms and gesturing enthusiastically, he told the reporter that at last, after so many years, the Narrows Crossing is no longer an academic dream. "There's going to be a bridge pretty soon, the bridge of my dreams," he said. "It's going to be the most important single piece of arterial construction in the world. It will be the longest suspension bridge in the world and the tallest. It will be the biggest bridge, the highest bridge, and the bridge with the greatest clearance. It's all superlatives when you talk about this bridge." Although he didn't talk to reporters about them, Moses had additional reasons for elation. The 1955 deal between the Port and Triborough authorities sealed, perhaps for centuries, the future of New York and its suburbs. And it sealed the future on his terms. In the background behind Moses marched a mighty division. The giant automobile manufacturers out of Detroit, the giant aluminum combines, the steel producers, the rubber producers, 50 oil companies, trucking firms in the hundreds, highway contractors in the thousands, consulting engineers, labor union leaders, auto dealers, tire dealers, petroleum dealers, rank upon rank of State Highway Department officials, Bureau of Public Roads bureaucrats, congressmen, senators, all the selfish interests whom author Helen Levitt was to label the highwaymen. That coalition was always behind him. It was no accident that he was the recipient in 1953 of a $25,000 award from the General Motors Corporation for the best essay in a nationwide contest on how to plan and pay for better highways, that some of Triborough's most lucrative franchises were held by oil companies, that the three automotive giants would later plow tens of millions of dollars into his World's Fair at a time when other major companies were shying away from it. In the sense that he was America's, and probably the world's, most vocal, effective, and prestigious apologist for the automobile, that he designed highway networks not only for New York, but for a dozen cities, that by his success in building expressways in the city, he did more than any other single urban official to encourage more hesitant officials to launch major highway building programs in their cities, and that, by building them to new, high standards, he did more than any other single urban official to set the early standards for urban expressway design. He was the spearhead, the cutting edge, of this Panzer division of public works. But thanks to the joint program, he was not forced to rely on any distant division. He was the spearhead of, he marched at the head of, his own elite local regiment. The joint program represented profit. Profit from bonds, deposits, contracts, premiums, retainers, jobs, payoffs, bribes, grease. It enlisted behind him all those forces in the city, banks, unions, contractors, venal politicians, venal or short-sighted public officials, who put profit from public works above the public interest or the public trust. And in the New York of the mid-20th century, those forces could bend the city's government to their will. The joint program represented profit on a scale hitherto undreamed of by even the greediest among them. The highways and bridges recommended in the joint program represented not millions of dollars, but hundreds of millions. In 1968, with some of the most expensive items in the program not yet underway, $1,817,701,607 had been spent on it. Moses did not have to urge these men on. The retainer regiment followed him eagerly. And the regiment marched in lockstep. The incentives offered to it by the joint program insured against the slightest break in its ranks. With the release of the overall program for the metropolitan region, protests from the ranks no longer concerned him. He could simply threaten, as he did again and again in the years to come, that if any part of the program was eliminated or even altered in any way whatsoever, he would see to it, by withdrawing from the program his Triborough Authority funds or his influence in Albany and Washington, that the entire program would be discarded. A borough president might be allowed to oppose a neighborhood-wrecking highway in public, but in private, where it counted, he could not take the action that would have meant genuine opposition, the invocation in Board of Estimate executive session of his veto power over projects in his own borough. John Cashmore might publicly assail Moses' plan to run a 12-lane approach to the Narrows Bridge through the heart of Bay Ridge instead of on a more logical route along the shore, but he had to privately okay Moses' route to the other members of the borough president's union. If he did not do so, Moses made clear, there would be no Narrows Bridge, and no $345 million in bonds and contracts. Moses' technique may have been a bluff, but officials who remembered how he had once canceled $23 million worth of projects in the Bronx because Jimmy Lyons balked at the Bruckner Expressway had too much at stake to call it. Occasionally, very occasionally, a public official might shy away from a politically dangerous proposal, but whether he was a borough president, a mayor, or a governor, he was quickly reined back into line. Into his office would pour the phone calls from the other members of the regiment, the phone calls that symbolized the behind-the-scenes, subtle, selfish pressure that spelled power in New York City. After the release of the joint program, the city didn't have a chance of rejecting the deal that had been arranged. And that deal, worked out by this lover of the bridge and the highway, meant that the city would, for long years to come, build bridges and highways, and nothing else. In January 1955, the two authorities had a combined immediate fundraising capacity of about $1.25 billion. $1.25 billion could have built a wonderful mass transportation system for New York and its suburbs. Triborough share alone, the close to $500 million that could have been raised from the sale of revenue bonds backed by its annual surpluses, would in 1955 have been more than enough to completely modernize the desperate Long Island Railroad, giving it sleek, gleaming cars, new, powerful, modern locomotives much faster than the old ones, and straighter tracks so that those locomotives could attain the speeds they were capable of. Triborough share would, in 1955, also have been more than enough to build atop the tracks at central locations in Queens and Nassau County multi-level parking garages so that thousands of commuters could drive to them, park, and simply take an elevator down to their trains, and in still sparsely developed Suffolk County to acquire sufficient land for and to build at a number of central locations entire huge modern commuter parking terminals. Triborough share would have been more than enough to build not only new modern switching yards so that passengers would no longer be forced to change trains at Jamaica, but a new East Side Long Island Railroad terminal in Manhattan. It would have been enough also, especially if right-of-way was obtained along the median strip of the Long Island Expressway, to build a whole new rapid transit line to supplement the three existing Long Island Railroad lines, a line with tracks so straight that trains could speed passengers in and out of the city at 80 miles per hour. It would have been more than enough, in short, to build what would in effect have been a whole new Long Island Railroad, a modern railroad capable of meeting the mass transportation needs of a modern metropolitan area and of attracting to mass transportation enough highway users to go a long way to solving the area's highway needs as well. The cost of such a system, impossibly expensive in 1974, would, in 1955, have been not $500 million, but $200 million. The Port Authority's share alone, more than $700 million, would have been more than enough to build a modern trans-Hudson rail loop that would connect New Jersey and Manhattan via two new under-river tunnels, one at the Battery and one at 59th Street, and would provide transfer stations to all the New Jersey railroads and all major New Jersey highways in the area, speeding 140,000 commuters, shoppers, and theatergoers per day, not just into Manhattan, but to wherever in those Manhattan business and commercial districts they wanted to go. There would be stops at Cedar, Canal, Houston, 8th, 14th, and other streets all the way north to Columbus Circle, and removing tens of thousands of cars from New Jersey highways, the Trans-Hudson vehicular tunnels, the West Side Highway, and Manhattan streets, so that those commuters who still used them would have easier trips also. The cost of such a system would, in 1955, have been about $300 million. If what was left over after the completion of the Long Island Railroad modernization and the Trans-Hudson tubes, about $700 million, was used on the city's subway system, it would have been more than enough to build the long-proposed and desperately needed 2nd Avenue subway, and to build a tunnel across the East River through which a branch of the 2nd Avenue line would extend out to Queens to provide adequate subway service there, and to build extensions of the existing subway lines in Queens to provide service to the hundreds of thousands of residents of eastern Queens who were miles from the nearest subway, and to extend the Nostrand Avenue subway in Brooklyn 3 miles along Flatbush Avenue to a new, modern terminal that would serve the growing Mill Basin area that possessed no rapid transit facilities at all, and to construct a new plaza and grade crossing elimination project at DeKalb Avenue that would eliminate switching delays which caused the most severe bottleneck in train service between Brooklyn and Manhattan. The total cost of these improvements in 1955 came to $600 million. And there were other alternatives. If, instead of spending part of it in the suburbs, the two authorities devoted their total revenue-raising capacity, $1.2 billion, to the subways instead of commuter facilities, it would have been sufficient to give the city a completely modern subway system. The total cost of a complete modernization was estimated by the Transit Authority in that year as $1.187 million. Even if only that portion of the capacity left after commuter improvements was used for subways, it might still have been sufficient to give New York a modern subway system. For during the decade following the joint proposal, the two authorities' annual revenues from tolls rose so much faster than expected, for their forecasters never understood, and therefore never took fully into account, the phenomenon of traffic generation, that their wealth far outstripped even their most optimistic expectations, and the amount available for mass transit facilities, if their total resources had been devoted to such facilities, might well have been not $1.25 billion, but more than $2 billion. The two authorities had it in their power in 1955 to make it possible for the people of the New York metropolitan region to travel around that region quickly, cheaply, and pleasantly. They had it in their power in January 1955 to change the way the region's millions lived. Instead, as a result of Robert Moses' joint program, the two authorities, with three major exceptions, Triborough's Coliseum, the Port Authority's substantial expenditures for airports, and for a 1960 takeover of the Hudson and Manhattan Railroad, spent their money on facilities for the automobile. Triborough spent, once the Coliseum expenditures were subtracted, 100% of its resources on the automobile. During the decade following the formulation of the joint program, Triborough spent $755 million on the bridges, tunnels, and highways advocated in that study, and not a cent on anything else. The authority funds that the joint program committed to facilities for motor vehicles widened more indirectly the disparity between public investment in such facilities and public investment in mass transit that was fostered by the program. During the following decade, 1955 to 1965, federal and state governments spent on new highways in the metropolitan area, the new highways recommended in the joint program, about $1.2 billion. They spent not a cent on mass transportation. New York City's own contribution to Moses' new highways is more difficult to calculate. hidden as so much of it is, owing to Moses' wiles, under hundreds of sewer, street opening, gas, and lighting items that bear no indication that they would not have been necessary had it not been for highway construction. But the city's expenditure for new facilities for motor vehicles almost certainly tops $500 million. During the decade following presentation of the joint program, therefore, public investment in new highways in and around New York was about $2.7 billion. The public investment in new mass transit facilities was a small fraction of this amount. During this decade, 439 miles of new highways were built, and not 1 mile of new railroad or subway. In 1974, people using subways and railroads in and around New York were still riding on tracks laid between 1904 and 1933, the last year before Robert Moses came to power in the city. Not a single mile had been built since. Because there were no subways or railroads into many newly developed areas, their residents could use mass transit only by first making their way to the old rail lines, often a journey in itself. More than half of all suburban rail commuters and subway riders from outlying areas of the city had to take a bus or car ride, often of considerable length, to the nearest subway or railroad station. At rush hours, the scenes at subway stations in the greatest city in history's richest and technologically most advanced civilization were incredible. At 100 stations, the traveler arrived each morning at the head of the stairs leading down onto the loading platforms to see beneath him, overflowing them, lapping precariously full to their very edges, a sea of humanity, a sea into which the traveler had no choice but to hurl himself. To get inside the trains, men and women pushed and shoved like irritable animals, rushing for seats as animals rush for a food trough, for without a seat they would have to stand, body crushed against body, strangers' smells in their nostrils, strangers' breath in their faces, in a press so dense that there could exist in it neither comfort nor dignity nor manners. Writers called subway cars cattle cars, said that people were crammed into them like sardines, and such non-human images were apt, for the crowding in New York subways, crowding to which hundreds of thousands of human beings were subjected day after day, year after year, for all the years of their working lives, was inhuman. Although most office workers were not due at work until 9 o'clock, on any weekday morning one could see around the subway stations in the outlying areas of the city, past the chain-link fences of the giant parking lots on Woodhaven Boulevard, near the giant new Lafrac City housing development in Queens, for example, long lines of men and women, during fall and winter huddling in their coats against the too early morning chill, hurrying for the stations at 7:45 or even 7:30, willing to forgo a half hour or more of sleep, willing to gulp down a coffee and Danish at the office instead of breakfasting at home, to avoid the worst of that degrading ordeal. By 8, it was already too late. As one observer described the scene at that hour, "The parking lots around the Woodhaven Boulevard station are filling up rapidly as cars stream from the expressway. Buses filled to capacity pull up and disgorge their passengers. Now the subway platform is packed 6 deep with people waiting impassively. As the local arrives, they surge forward, merging, pushing, straining. Some clutch newspapers, but they cannot move, much less read. At Roosevelt Avenue, the express trains arriving from Jamaica, Kew Gardens, and Forest Hills are jammed to the doors, but somehow more bodies squeeze inside. By 8:30, the crowd at Woodhaven Boulevard backs up the stairs. Those in the rear files must wait for one and perhaps 2 locals before they can wedge themselves aboard." Crowded though they were, the Queens subway lines were not as crowded as the lines running down from the Bronx along the east side of Manhattan. Since shortly after World War I, the city had been promising to build a Second Avenue subway to service those areas. Lying in the bottom drawer of the desk of a city engineer whose job dealt with subway design was a set of plans. "My father, a civil servant in the same department, gave me these plans when I came into the business in 1929, he would tell friends. They would unroll the plans, and the friends would laugh at seeing they were plans for the Second Avenue subway. After World War II, the city, having torn down the old Second Avenue L, which served a portion of the same area, repeated its promise. In 1955, in the process of tearing down the Third Avenue L, which serviced part of the same area, the city promised that construction was imminent. But in 1965, the subway would still not be built, or even begun. And the thousands of passengers who had used the two old elevated lines had to pack into the already crammed Lexington Avenue IRT line. By 1965, the average car in the southbound express, designed for an absolute maximum capacity of 120 passengers, was jammed during the morning rush hour with some 170 passengers, which, as one study indicated, is just about the maximum short of suffocation. There were available in 1955, the year of the authorities' joint program, technological innovations which could have increased not only subway capacity, but subway speed. Not one of any significance was instituted. The rides were as long as ever. Longer, for the lack of available operating funds forced continual cutbacks in express service. The cars into which subway riders were crammed were cars 30 and 40 years old in 1955 and due for replacement. Such replacement would have been possible with the authority's surplus. They were not replaced, and in 1965, almost 20% of New York subway cars had been in use for more than half a century. In winter, because of their ancient, malfunctioning heating systems, subway cars were cold. In the summer, particularly on the IRT, built in 1904, because in 1904 construction techniques to ventilate subway tunnels had not yet been invented, they were so swelteringly hot that one writer compared a ride on them to incarceration in the black hole of Calcutta. Not only were new cars not purchased, the old ones were not repaired. It was about 1956 that there was instituted on the New York City subway system, because of lack of funds, a policy of deferred maintenance, a phrase which, translated into practice, meant that brakes and signals and switches were inspected less frequently, that wheels were ground round to keep rides smooth less frequently, that electrical relays which should have been replaced every 5 years were replaced every 30 years, that the vast system was sometimes completely out of light bulbs to replace burnt-out signals, alcohol to keep switches from freezing, and other basic supplies. So superbly engineered and maintained had the subway been previously, New York had once been enormously proud of its subways, that it took years for this systematic neglect to take its toll. But every year after 1956, every criterion of subway performance, on-time runs, individual car breakdowns, disclosed that the toll was steadily mounting. By the late 1960s, the day of full reckoning had arrived. 17,070 runs had to be halted during a single 8-month period. 45 cars were breaking down on an average day. 40 trains were derailed in a single year. By the time Robert Moses left power, the Times could report that on a system that had for decades been called, accurately, the safest subway in the world, there have been more serious accidents in the last 10 years than on any other major subway system in the world. In the last year, there have been more accident injuries than on any other system. During a single 7-month period, there were 4 major accidents. In one, an empty IND local, being operated from the third car because the brakes in the first 2 cars no longer worked, smashed into a crowded local near Roosevelt Avenue, killing 2 persons and injuring 70 others. In another, a clogged South Bronx catch basin, cleaning machines had not been replaced as they wore out, turned IRT tunnels into gigantic storm sewers as water cascaded down air shafts and stairways, trapping 30,000 passengers for up to 3 hours in subway tunnels where the temperature reached 100 degrees in a disaster in which one woman died and 150 passengers suffered heat prostration. During this same 7-month period, 4 separate fires in subway tunnels under the city, caused at least in part by equipment that an investigating grand jury was to call inherently dangerous and defective, sent thousands of terrified, smoke-blinded passengers stumbling out into the subterranean murk to grope their way to emergency exits and reach the street above via manholes. One blaze, toll, one dead, 50 felled by smoke poisoning, went unreported for long minutes. The motorman's radio was out of order. Less dramatic than the injury toll, but wearing on the tens of thousands of subway riders who were never involved in a major disaster, was the daily toll imposed by calculated neglect. The floors of New York's subways were filthy, and the grime was mixed with scattered pages of newspapers, candy and gum wrappers, and, for emphasis, an occasional blob of spittle or a smear of vomit that no one had yet wiped up. Subway walls were covered with verbal filth. The scenery amid which the New Yorker traveled around his city was a vast mosaic of fuck and suck and cock and cunt. Knowing that they could no longer rely for safety on brakes and signals, the operating authorities responsible for the subways responded to each major disaster by placing more and more of their reliance on caution. Trains crept where once they could have safely speeded, and ground to a halt at the slightest possibility of danger ahead. Consequently, the time New Yorkers were forced to spend daily shivering or sweltering on those bumpy, jolting, filthy trains grew longer and longer. Where once the average trip from the city's outskirts to its center had been 40 or 45 minutes, now it was an hour or more. When Robert Moses came to power in New York in 1934, the city's mass transportation system was probably the best in the world. When he left power in 1968, it was quite possibly the worst. With money, you could buy almost anything in mid-20th century New York. But you couldn't buy a decent trip to and from work. Wealthier families might move to the suburbs, but Moses' joint proposal of 1955 had sealed the fate of the metropolitan region's 9 suburban commuter railroads. In 1955, some of those railroads were still healthy. The New Haven, profitable, clean, and punctual, had just purchased scores of gleaming new cars. The Penn Central's Harlem and Hudson divisions were, one commentator said, a model of how to keep 42,000 daily commuters happy. But others were teetering precariously on the brink of financial disaster. The Long Island, the commuter line most directly in Moses' line of fire, had in fact been shoved over the brink. It had plunged into bankruptcy in 1949 and had been kept alive, barely alive, thereafter, only by a series of state tax concessions. Moses' joint program expressways siphoned off the railroad's customers precisely as the planners had predicted. The railroads were private corporations in existence for the sole purpose of showing a profit. To show one, they would have had to compete successfully with the public authorities that were their competitors. But while the authorities' toll-charging facilities were subsidized by hundreds of millions of dollars of connecting highways, by freedom from taxes on their hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate and on their income, the railroads enjoyed no such subsidies and were trapped as well by mounting labor costs, minimal to authorities operating only low-maintenance bridges and tunnels. Every railroad attempt during this decade to obtain meaningful subsidies was defeated by New York's local highwaymen, the banks, construction unions, contractors, engineering and bonding and building supply firms, and politicians who reaped profit from Moses Highways, a coalition led by Triborough's chairman, who, as its prestigious public spokesman, on one occasion assured Congress that no subsidy was needed because there is little need for an expansion of railroad commuter facilities in the New York metropolitan area. And on another, when an impartial private study called a subsidy imperative, dynamited it by assuring the public that the major problem was simply that the railroads were not as efficient, prudent, practical, and businesslike as the public authorities, stating, "These railroads have got to be more ingenious. Bailing out busted, lazy, and backward private enterprises is not the business of government." Moses added that mass transportation needs could be met on highways as well as on railroads. "A great deal of passenger traffic today consists of carpools, an immeasurably more convenient and less expensive system, he said. Unable to compete with the authorities, the railroads grew poorer as their rivals grew richer. Even those which in 1955 had been showing profits, by 1959 or 1960 were showing losses, bigger losses every year. By the early 1960s, those who still possessed any money in the bank were living off it just to stay alive, and were rapidly consuming the last of it. They had no alternative but to raise fares and cut back service, moves that touched off a self-defeating cycle. Each fare increase and service cutback drove railroad passengers to the highways. The Long Island Railroad increased fares 5 times during 10 years. After each increase, the railroad collected 1 million fewer fares per year. A decade after the joint proposal, with millions of new potential customers, the commuter railroads were providing substantially less service. The Long Island Railroad, which during the 1920s had run between 50 and 60 trains per hour into Manhattan, in 1965, with Long Island's commuter population up more than 200%, ran between 20 and 30. The service that was provided in 1965 or 1968, the year Robert Moses left power, should be chronicled in depth. Otherwise, future urban historians will dismiss oral and daily press descriptions of that service as exaggeration. The Long Island Railroad, for example, was, in the words of one reporter, the kind of train that, if smaller, would make your little boy cry if he found it under his Christmas tree. With its creaking, rickety 1900 vintage coaches, it resembled the comic strip Toonerville Trolley. Humorist Russell Baker, naming it the Looneyville Trolley, said that it was nationally recognized as the worst railroad of any kind in the entire country. Railroad buffs from all over the world came to New York to look at it. A few would even have ridden on it, in spite of the warnings of medical science, except that they made the mistake of going to the station when the timetable said the Long Island would be there, and therefore could never find it. But if the Long Island was a joke, it was a bitter joke. Its riders laughed because, as one of them, Al Casuto of Woodmere, put it, "What else can you do but laugh? If you don't, you'll go crazy." Living standards on affluent Long Island were high even for America. The homes of many Long Island Railroad commuters were large, luxurious, thickly carpeted, richly draperied, crammed with the most modern appliances for cleanliness and cooking. The vicissitudes of climate were eliminated for them, not only in their homes. No county in America had so many centrally air-conditioned homes as Nassau, but in their automobiles, all of them heated, most of them air-conditioned. These automobiles, the automobiles out of which Long Islanders stepped every weekday morning to board the Long Island Railroad, symbolized the degree to which the affluence and technological genius of America had given its people a life cushioned against physical discomfort. Then the train arrived, and the Long Islanders climbed aboard. The linoleum on the floors of the coaches into which they stepped was cracked and split, impacted with layers of grime. Paint was flaking off grimy walls. The windows, so thickly smeared with grime that you could hardly see through some of them, were filled with spider webs, and with the lacy spread of thin cracks radiating out from holes smashed in them and never repaired. Some of the holes were covered with bits of cardboard held on with tape. Others gaped jaggedly. The seats were ripped and humped. Their springs were sprung. Their backs sagged limply backwards. Sitting in those seats meant sitting in dirt. If you rested your arm on a windowsill, your coat sleeve came away covered with dust. You sat with your feet among wads of chewed-up gum, on which the spittle had long since dried, among gum and candy wrappers, sheets of newspapers, fragments of ice cream cones, and occasionally discarded hunks of food. It was a good idea not to let your eyes focus on the floor. You might see drobs of spittle or fat bugs scuttling by your bright and shiny shoes. Yet men pushed and shoved for those seats. For those who didn't get them had to stand, and standing on the Long Island's swaying, lurching coaches wasn't easy. Particularly because one might have to stand for quite a long time. Even when it was running on time, the Long Island Railroad was slow, incredibly slow. and the railroad seemed almost never to be running on time. There were days, in fact, on which, because of equipment malfunctions in the LIRR's main Pennsylvania Station terminal, every Long Island train was late. There were days on which every Long Island train was hours late. Some commuters couldn't remember when last they had been on time. In tabulating the number of delayed trains, the LIRR did not even bother counting those delayed less than 10 minutes. Even so, the daily figures were not unremarkable. Here is one day's record. Trains canceled yesterday, 1. Commuters affected, 1,000. Trains more than 10 minutes late, 187. Total time lost, 74 hours, 15 minutes. Commuters affected, 140,250. Getting a seat was not total victory. Getting an end seat was what counted. Many of the LIRR seats had been designed for 3 people, but they had been designed half a century before, when people were smaller. There wasn't enough room for 3 people. Sitting in even an end seat was indignity. It was sitting with your shoulder and thigh tight against a stranger's shoulder and thigh, pressing into him at every lurch, pressing against him while opening a newspaper or reaching into a pocket for your train ticket, surreptitiously taking advantage of shifts in his position to gain an extra 1/4 inch of room for your leg or arm. But sitting in the middle was indignity doubled. The person sitting there was crushed from both sides, leaned into from both sides, without room to make an unrestricted movement of any kind. "Of all the things I hated about the Long Island Railroad," says one woman, "the worst was sitting in the middle on those seats. You'd have men pressing against you on both sides. They didn't mean anything by it. Some of them were sleeping and lying all over you, but it made me feel dirty. Standing at rush hour, it was the same thing. There'd be men leaning all over you. But being stuck in the middle on those seats was worse. There was never a time it happened that I didn't get off the train feeling dirty." It was no wonder that the first 2 persons to reach the 3-man seats took the 2 end positions, and that when a 3rd arrived, invariably the one sitting on the outside, closest to the aisle, would, instead of politely sliding over to make room for the new man on the outside, stand up and let him by to take the middle seat, careful not to look him in the eye. In winter, the trips were cold. Heating equipment half a century old and haphazardly maintained could not be expected to work well. Not that even modern, well-maintained equipment could have kept heat at a coach in which it seemed that every other window either had a hole in it or could not be shut tightly. A reporter who took a thermometer into an LIRR train one winter day, not by any means the coldest day of the winter, found that the temperature aboard was 29 degrees. Men who in home and office enjoyed temperature control to the precise degree had to travel between home and office, huddled shivering in their coats. And winter was, perhaps, better than summer. The crush in the cars kept the temperature up, and in winter that was a help. In summer, it was not, and help was needed, since 70% of the LIRR's ancient rolling stock did not have air conditioning equipment. Men who tried frantically to open windows, one could watch them tug on them furiously every few minutes on a long summer ride home, found them stuck fast. A reporter who took a thermometer onto a jam-packed LIRR train one summer day, not by any means the hottest day of the summer, found that the temperature aboard was 98 degrees. Men who would not have dreamed of living in a home or working in an office that was not air-conditioned rode each day between home and office, sweltering, the sweat forming in their armpits and crotches and running down their backs and legs. Long Island Railroad trains did not always run late. Sometimes they did not run at all. Year by year, as already old equipment grew older, the number of trains that simply broke down on the track increased. It was no longer unusual to see a train arrive in Jamaica being pushed along by another train. The number of trains that didn't even make it out onto a track increased. By 1964, it was not unusual for the railroad to cancel 10 trains per day. One train, the 7:45 a.m. from Babylon to Brooklyn, did not appear for 102 consecutive days. Would-be passengers named it the Phantom. Long Islanders' lives were cushioned, approximately 22 hours out of every 24, by all the material wonders the 20th century could provide. For those other 2 hours, 2 hours that could with accuracy have been called Robert Moses' 2 hours, for he had made them what they were, they lived like 19th century Russian peasants. There comes a time, H.L. Mencken said, when every normal man is tempted to spit on his hands, haul up the black flag, and begin slitting throats. The LIRR's conductors were not responsible for conditions on the railroad. The commuters knew that, rationally. But the conductors were a visible symbol of the railroad's management on which the commuters could vent their frustration. Men normally rational found themselves snarling and cursing conductors, refusing to show them their tickets. As a result, men who would not have been able to conceive of themselves being arrested suddenly found themselves in that state. Arrested, as one reporter put it. Portly, balding, mild-mannered, 53-year-old Seymour Cummins, district sales manager, commuter, family man. Seymour Cummins, of all people, being let off the train by 2 policemen, one on each arm, as his wife watched in disbelief. By 1968, the year Robert Moses left power, commuters were, as one writer put it, so surly that the conductors occasionally choose, like prudent lion tamers, not to enter the cage. One freezing evening at Jamaica, while commuters huddled in downstairs waiting rooms because the waiting rooms near the tracks upstairs were unheated, a malfunctioning public address system prevented them from hearing announcements of incoming trains. Storming upstairs in sudden senseless fury, 250 commuters began pounding on the glass walls of the announcer's booth, trying to get at the terrified occupant. They had broken the glass when police arrived to pull them away. On another freezing night, a train broke down some miles from the nearest station. Its passengers got off and began throwing rocks at it. Similar incidents occurred again and again. One evening in Penn Station, with 150 rush-hour trains running late, a 58-year-old bank employee from Bayside, enraged because a conductor would not open the doors to let him on a train that had loaded but had been standing for close to half an hour on the platform, reached through the window to the engineer's booth, grabbed something, and refused to let go. And when the railroad police rushed up to pull him away, suddenly, as one police sergeant put it, this place was wall-to-wall people, thousands of people, pulling at the policemen, punching them. It was a riot down there, the sergeant said. It was actually a riot. And it was testimony to the rage to which conditions on New York's railroads could drive men. Actual physical violence was, of course, unusual, and therefore it is not in violence that the true toll of commuting on the Long Island Railroad should be computed. It is in the norm, to which the violence is only occasional violent punctuation. The norm that endures day after day, week after week, year after year, for tens of thousands of commuters. The LIRR carried 80,000 daily, that the toll of commuting should be computed. The true extent of this toll can perhaps be described in psychiatric terms. The chairman of the Nassau County Mental Health Board, in one of the first detailed studies of the subject, discovered a commuter syndrome, a mild state of chronic stress resulting from internalized rage and frustration due to the uncertainty of disrupted schedules. It was most serious in commuters who were business executives, overly worrying, driving, ambitious, and aggressive types. Such a person, who preserves his valuable time by living to a tight schedule, is tremendously vulnerable, psychologically speaking, to transportation failures. But the commuter syndrome, the study found, was not present only in executives. 3 out of every 4 commuters tested suffered from its symptoms, chronically. But it did not take a psychiatrist to compute the toll. A layman could do it by asking commuters in a relaxed setting, a cocktail party perhaps, about commuting and then taking note of the contrast between the answers he gets from young men or men recently moved to a new home on Long Island and those he gets from older men. A young man might say, as 26-year-old Michael Lieberman of Dix Hills did one evening, "People's lives revolve around the railroad. You can spend 5 hours a day on it, and then you're just too tired to work." He might say, as 36-year-old Alan Siegel of Roslyn did one evening, "I think we're out of our minds to do this. The trip home is worse than 8 or 9 hours at the office." Men who have been commuting for years, however, generally do not go into detail, nor do they complain much. Their standard reply, one so standard that the questioner can hear it a dozen times in a dozen conversations, apparently sincere, is, "Oh, you get used to it after a while." The implications of that reply should be considered. Get used to it. Accept as part of your daily existence 2 or 3 or more hours sitting amid dirt, crammed against strangers, breathing foul air, sweating in summer, shivering in winter. Accept that you will be doing this for a substantial portion of every working day of your life until you are old. Get used to it. One has to think about what those words, so casually uttered, really mean. One has to realize that the man uttering those words has accepted discomfort and exhaustion as a part, a substantial part, of the fabric of his life. Accepted them so completely that he no longer really thinks about them, or about the amount of his life of which they are, day by day, robbing him. We learn to tolerate intolerable conditions. The numbness that is the defense against intolerable pain has set in, so firmly that many of the victims no longer even realize that the pain is pain. One should listen to the wives of these men, to be more precise, the younger wives, say, as Mrs. Mary Severine of Huntington, whose husband Lewis was general manager of advertising for the American Broadcasting Company, says, "We never plan anything during the week. There's got to be something more in life than Saturday night." Older wives do not talk much about it. After enough years, they don't complain that there's got to be something more in life than Saturday night. They just forget that there ever was. And then, to comprehend the full toll of commuting, one should try to imagine, for no one has yet arrived at an objective method of measuring it, the total human cost, individual cost times 80,000, of commuting under such conditions. It may be that the cost, the total toll in human terms, is too large to be imagined. But if one makes the effort nonetheless, and obtains even a glimpse of its dimensions, one can get a glimpse of the true cost of Robert Moses' transportation policies on Long Island. And Long Island was not the only New York suburban railroad on the track toward chaos. It was only the first of many making that journey. When Moses had first come to power in the suburbs, in 1924, New York's suburban railroads had been in good shape. As late as 1955, when he formulated his joint program, most of them had still been in fair shape. By the time he left power in 1968, they were all as much of a bitter joke as the Long Island. The New Haven Railroad had in 1955 been a model of punctuality, cleanliness, and profitability. In 1968, as one headline put it, "On the New Haven, LIRR looks good." By 1968, moreover, with the annual surplus of Moses Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority running more than $30 million per year, every suburban railroad in the New York metropolitan area was either bankrupt or teetering on the brink. The massive migration to the city's outlying precincts and to the suburbs beyond had created hundreds of thousands of new commuters. Had the subways and railroads been extended into these regions and improved with the authority funds available in 1954, they would have been used by many of these commuters. Had they been merely maintained at even their old levels, with their old fares, not improved, just maintained, they would at least have kept those riders they already had. But, disintegrating, they did not. After the joint program, the number of rides taken annually on New York subways and commuter railroads declined by almost 2 million per year. Commuters by the tens and hundreds of thousands had been forced onto the highways and bridges Robert Moses had laid out under the joint program and had been building ever since. And it was on those highways and bridges, the creations of a single individual, public works sprung from that individual's private creative vision, financed and approved as a result of his unique political genius, driven to completion by his savage drive and unswerving will, that the effect of that single individual's policies on the 12 million individuals who lived in the New York metropolitan region was most clear. Those highways and bridges were awesome. The transportation network built by Robert Moses after World War II ranks with the greatest feats of urban construction in recorded history. Possibly it outranks them all. Possibly it is history's greatest feat of urban construction. The longest tunnel in the Western Hemisphere, the longest suspension bridge in the world, the largest and most complex traffic interchanges ever built. These were all merely segments of that achievement. Its overall scale can perhaps best be grasped by a single statistic, mileage. The urban highways, controlled access through roads within cities and the heavily populated surrounding suburbs, built in America during the quarter century following the Second World War, dwarfed any urban highway or system of highways built in any country in the world any time in recorded history. In 1964, when Robert Moses completed his major highway building, there were completed or well underway in the New York metropolitan region 899 miles of such highways, 627 built by him, many of the rest, most of which were in New Jersey, built as a result of the joint program he worked out with the Port Authority. No other metropolitan region in America possessed 700 miles of such highways. No other metropolitan region possessed 600 miles, or 500. Even Los Angeles, which presented itself to history as the most highway-oriented of cities, which was, in fact, not a city in the older sense in which New York was a city, but a collection of suburbs whose very existence was due to highways, possessed in 1964 only 459 miles of such highways. No city in America had more than half as many miles of such highways as New York. But nothing about his roads was as awesome as the congestion on them. 1955 was also a turning point for New York and its suburbs, because that was the year construction started on the Long Island Expressway. Long Island, that vast, empty, beautiful open area beyond the city line that Moses had looked upon in 1923, had since been covered, thanks largely to his parkways, his starving of its railroads, his initiation and encouragement of industry-excluding zoning, with a formless, unfocused sprawl of subdivisions, mile upon endless mile of land-gobbling, single-family, large-lot developments that were not only destroying the very assets that he prized, its openness, its spaciousness, its beautiful North Shore hills and South Shore marshes and wetlands, its ocean and bay and sound, but were replacing it with communities that were not communities, that had no downtowns, none of the focal points that alone make meaningful community development possible, and that were so spread out that a trip to anywhere, store, church, school, movie, business, generally required a car, so that the lives of its residents were eaten up by the difficulties in getting from one place to another. The construction of the expressway offered a chance to reshape the island, to free its people from the tyranny of the automobile. Just laying two rapid transit tracks down the expressway's center mall would have done the job. Without them, expressway-fostered development would follow the same pattern as the development fostered previously by Moses Parkways, and for the same reasons. Its users would be arriving at their exits in the evenings in cars. It would not make that much difference to them if their homes were located miles from an exit. Having been driving for an hour or more, it wouldn't matter to them if they had to drive for another 15 or 20 minutes. They would be accustomed to driving, oriented to cars, and their homes would therefore spread out widely over the land. But men arriving on high-speed rapid transit would feel as men arriving home on the subways felt. Many would want to be able to walk home. More important, they would not be car-oriented in general. They would want to live in neighborhoods rather than subdivisions. You would therefore have, as you had in New York City, high-density development, apartment houses, private homes on small plots, in the central corridor up which the expressway was to run. As was proven by Long Island's existing apartment house development, concentrated almost exclusively within a block or two of major LIRR stations in communities such as Great Neck, Rosalind, Mineola, Hempstead, Rockville Center, Freeport, and Baldwin. Higher population densities make feasible the construction of theaters and large department stores, of museums and reference libraries, and people living in or near the central corridor would therefore be able to reach these facilities, and their churches, doctors, dentists, and their sons' Boy Scout troop meetings, on foot or in buses. For high densities, support convenient local bus service. For people living in the central corridor, it would not be necessary to get into cars every time they left the house. Automobile usage for the island as a whole would, at a stroke, be dramatically slashed. In terms of transportation alone, building rapid transit on the Long Island Expressway would immensely improve the lives of millions of people. And there were other terms of improvement as well. Long Island's Central Corridor also contained both the Northern State Parkway and the LIRR's Central Line. Building the expressway would lure industry to that corridor. Industry was already attracted to it because of the LIRR line. Planners had long been urging that the lure be strengthened by improving the LIRR and linking its Brooklyn terminal to the New Jersey railroads, a move that would make it immensely more attractive to freight shippers. Their hopes would finally be dashed by Moses' refusal to consider an alternative location for the Verrazano Bridge that would have made such a link feasible. As industry moved to Long Island's spine, so would its workers, and there would be enough of them who wanted to live close to their jobs to further increase those densities and the apartment houses and variety of services those densities would support. The island, now without a focus, would be given one. Its overall development would, at a stroke, be made more orderly. People who wanted to live in apartments or near stores or jobs or rapid transit to New York would live in the center of the island instead of having to live like everyone else in sprawling subdivisions. People who preferred larger home sites to convenience would live farther away from the center. Densities would therefore get lower and lower the farther one moved from the center. People who wanted open space would have been able to find more of it, larger lots for their houses, more parks and woods preserved, for they would no longer be so valuable to developers. People who wanted open space, in other words, would be able to find more of it on Long Island at the same time that people who wanted a more urban type of life could have found that too. The concentration of population down the center of the island would preserve at least some of the island's beauty away from the center. Building rapid transit on the Long Island Expressway was not only the best way to rescue Long Islanders from the automobile, but the only way. The island's transportation problem was complicated by one unblinkable geographical fact. Long Island was an island, connected by Moses to the mainland at only one end. Its other end stuck out into the Atlantic Ocean, connected to nothing. It was a cul-de-sac, a dead end. It might be a gigantic dead end, 116 miles long, an average of 12 miles wide. It contained 1,404 square miles, but it was a dead end nonetheless. Manufacturers wanting to import raw materials or ship out finished products had only one way to go, and so did commuters heading for the great corporate headquarters lumped together on Manhattan Island, housewives heading for Manhattan's museums, art galleries, and theaters, anyone who wanted to leave the island for any purpose whatever. As an industrial mortgage broker put it, "You can't think east. It's got to be west. Your raw materials have to come in from the west. Your finished products have to go out to the west. And the west is New York, and New York is congestion." In 1955, Long Island's population was already 6,200,000, greater than that of 41 states. but forecasters were predicting that by 1985, the population would be at least 8,500,000. Forecasters agreed, moreover, that little of this increase would come in Brooklyn and Queens, the part of the island within the city limits, and relatively little in western or central Nassau County. Most of the land on Long Island for a distance of 30